Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, March 28th, 2022. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. President Biden unveiled his 2023 budget plan to Congress today. It calls for record military spending while raising taxes on billionaires and corporations. According to a White House fact sheet, the $5.73 trillion plan includes more than $770 billion in defense spending, $1 billion in aid to Ukraine, and nearly $7 billion for the European Defense Initiative and NATO. We'll have more on the budget coming up. The Senate Judiciary Committee met today for the first time since last week's confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin said a final vote on the Jackson nomination will be held on April 4th, with a full Senate vote a few days later. We'll hear from Chair Durbin and Ranking Member Chuck Grassley coming up. A federal judge has found that former President Trump likely committed felony obstruction in his effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. U.S. District Court Judge David Carter made the ruling in a case over whether some of former Trump attorney John Eastman's private communications could be withheld from the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Judge Carter ruled that Mr. Eastman must turn over the documents to the committee. And his decision reads in part, quote, "The illegality of the plan was obvious. Our nation was founded on the peaceful transition of power, epitomized by George Washington laying down his sword to make way for democratic elections. Ignoring this history, President Trump vigorously campaigned for the vice president to single-handedly determine the results of the 2020 election." Judge Carter goes on to name two possible felonies committed, obstruction of an official proceeding and conspiracy to defraud the United States. And top officials at the U.S. Agency for International Development are privately warning the White House and Capitol Hill that the agency will soon run out of money to help global COVID-19 vaccinations. Jeremy Canindike, director of the agency's COVID-19 task force, told Politico that 90% of the American Rescue Plan funding for emergency COVID-19 programs has either been spent or is in the process of being used. And with a $4 billion request now stalled in Congress, USAID officials are now planning for their funding to run out in the next few months, limiting their ability to vaccinate vulnerable populations in dozens of countries. But we begin with President Biden's fiscal year 2023 budget plan. The $5.73 trillion plan calls for record military spending. It also raises taxes on billionaires and corporations. At a press conference today, the president talked about his budget's priorities.
My dad had an expression. He said, "Don't tell me what you value. Show me your budget. I'll tell you what you value. Don't tell me what you value. Show me your budget, and I'll tell you what you value." Well, the budget I'm releasing today sends a clear message to the American people that we value. First, fiscal responsibility. Second, safety and security. And thirdly, the investments needed to build a better America. The first value is fiscal responsibility. The previous administration, as you all know, ran up record budget deficits. In fact, the deficit went up every year under my predecessor. My administration is turning that around. Last year, we cut the deficit by more than $350 billion. This year, we're on track to cut the deficit by more than $1.3 trillion. $1.3 trillion. That would be the largest one-year reduction in the deficit in U.S. history. And here's how we're achieving it, this record deficit reduction. First, we're growing the economy. We've created a record 6.7 million jobs since I took office, and we've generated a GDP growth of 5.7%, the best economic growth we've seen in this country in over 40 years. This has led to a substantial increase in government revenues and dramatically improved our fiscal situation. Secondly, this record economic and job growth has made it possible for us to responsibly and significantly cut back on emergency spending. Earlier in the pandemic, it was right to give people help to make ends meet and to keep this economy going. Because of the progress we've made dealing with these emergencies, the labor market is strong and unemployment claims are at historic lows. We ended the pandemic unemployment assistance programs because Americans are back to work. I'm calling for new pandemic subsidies for large businesses to not continue those because those businesses are back and moving again as well. But because we have to put this economy in a strong foundation, even the Delta and Omicron variants of COVID-19 and the cost of Putin's aggression in Ukraine have not required an additional fiscal package for state and local governments.
And we heard the president mention deficit reduction. This 2023 plan also aims to reduce the deficit by more than $1 trillion, in part by including a minimum 20% tax on billionaires and a 7% corporate tax rate increase. It also includes robust funding for domestic law enforcement programs and community violence intervention, and more than $1 billion for a Justice Department firearm trafficking strike force. Here's more from the president.
On your budget, you've said repeatedly at the State of the Union that you're not for defunding the police. I do wonder how much emphasis you think should be put on alternative forms of crime prevention, not just defunding the police, but crime reduction in communities.
Oh, a significant amount. I've laid that out in detail in the budget. For example, we do know that intervention programs work. We do know that what police need, they need psychologists in the department as much as they need extra rifles. They need people who are in the department who can deal with the crisis that the police are going through as well, dealing with their crises, dealing with their mental state and how they're handling things. They need social workers engaged with them. I lay it all out. And it all works. If you see these community intervention programs, they work. They actually reduce crime. They significantly reduce crime. So that's a big piece of it.
Just a follow-up. Is any of it related to political pressure from Republicans saying that Democrats are soft on crime, that you guys are careening to the left?
Isn't it kind of fascinating? When I first got elected, I was being beat up because I supported the police too much for the previous 30 years.
The Biden budget also includes more than $90 billion to the Health and Human Services Department and the CDC for public health infrastructure and workforce, and the largest ever investment in science and natural history, including $26 billion to NASA. And in Florida this afternoon, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson talked about the historic investment in his agency.
We're having this discussion today because President Biden and his administration released this budget request, and it came this morning, and NASA's $26 billion fiscal year budget for 23, it's a request from the president, from us, and it is a significant increase over last year's budget. In fact, it's 8% more than the enacted federal spending levels, the appropriation bill, from fiscal year 22. It's the largest request for science in NASA history. But greater than any number or statistic or a fact is what this budget request represents. It's a signal of support of our missions in a new era of exploration and discovery. It's an investment in the business and the corporations and the universities that all partner with NASA in all 50 states. And by the way, good paying jobs that they create. It's going to help our nation. It's going to help the world. It's going to address climate change. And it underscores STEM education, and it promotes diversity and equity. And it expresses confidence in this extraordinary workforce that we have that makes NASA, you know it, the best place in the federal government to work.
NASA Administrator Bill Nelson. According to a White House fact sheet, the plan includes more than $770 billion in defense spending, $1 billion in aid to Ukraine, and nearly $7 billion for the European Defense Initiative and NATO. And with more on what the Pentagon is getting, here's Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks.
While we remain dynamic in our ability to respond to new threats across the globe, the Department will focus our campaigning efforts in the Indo-Pacific and Europe. Through our Pacific Deterrence Initiative, as well as other efforts focused in the region, the Department is making investments to support our comparative military advantage, enhance our posture, provide for resilient logistics, and increase cooperation with our regional allies and partners. Similarly, our budget request makes investments that support U.S. European Command and deepen our ironclad commitment to NATO. We will optimize the responsiveness of the joint force, provide assistance to Kyiv through the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, and bolster security cooperation programs. The strategy's third approach to support both integrated deterrence and campaigning is to build enduring advantages across the department's enterprise. This begins by building the workforce that we need, investing in our most critical asset, our people. We will provide a 4.6% pay raise for our civilian and military personnel and invest in providing quality, affordable childcare as well. Building enduring advantages also means that the department must continue to innovate and modernize. Of the roughly $130 billion that we are investing in RDT&E, our largest request ever, $16.5 billion is dedicated to science and technology, and we make other significant investments in more mature artificial intelligence and 5G programs.
And response coming in from Capitol Hill. In his leader time remarks, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell criticized the president's budget priorities, starting with his defense spending.
President Biden likes to say, and said again today, that budgets are statements of values. Indeed, they can be. And the White House budget request that President Biden published today offers the clearest possible reminder that the Biden administration's far-left values are fundamentally disconnected from what American families actually need. I mentioned around President Biden's State of the Union that the speech gave the president a chance to pivot. He's had a chance to assess the poll numbers, read the tea leaves, and make a dramatic course correction back toward where Americans would like for him to be. But he chose not to, and this budget proposal is just the mathematical version of that failure to pivot. The White House is desperately spinning to call this budget centrist, but there's nothing remotely moderate about what's in it. First and foremost, at a dangerous time, the president's budget falls woefully short on defense spending. Our commander-in-chief has again failed to budget for the resources that our armed forces actually need. The Biden administration proposes a nominal 4% increase for defense over the bipartisan bill Congress just passed for this year.
Also on Capitol Hill today, the Senate Judiciary Committee met for the first time since last week's confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Dick Durbin said a final vote on the Jackson nomination will be held on April 4th with a full Senate vote a few days later. Here's Chairman Durbin.
Last week, the committee spent more than 30 hours over 4 days considering Judge Jackson's nomination. I described it as a trial by ordeal for the nominee, and I believe it was nothing less. I came away personally very impressed. It's clear why she has been reported out of this committee 3 times before with bipartisan support. We saw her qualifications and broad legal experience, her devotion to her family, her country, and the rule of law. We saw her commitment to liberty, justice, and the Constitution. A constitution that should work for all Americans. And then there is the issue of temperament. The majority of members on both sides, the majority, were fair and respectful. Unfortunately, in the words of one Republican member of the committee, there were examples of a word I had not heard before, quote, jackassery, close quote, and playing to the social media and the cameras. But in the face of gross distortions of her record and repeated false attacks on her motives, Judge Jackson showed rock-steady grace and poise. She was, in short, a model for judicial temperament, a virtue which all of us in public life should aspire to. I want to briefly address two or three of the claims made by her opposition last week. First, a number of my Republican colleagues suggested she just doesn't have a judicial philosophy. Well, respectfully, that's just not true. But to find that philosophy, it's not going to be a declaration of a label. You have to take the time to read any or all of the 578 written opinions which she'd issued and 12,000 pages of committee testimony before the Sentencing Committee. My Republican colleagues should keep in mind that they have supported many of President Trump's nominees who also declined labels when it came to judicial philosophies.
Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Dick Durbin. You can see all of today's hearing at cspan.org and on our free C-SPAN Now video app. And also speaking today, Judiciary Ranking Member Chuck Grassley of Iowa.
I join in the request to hold over the nominees for 1 week. I'll have specific things to say about the nomination of Judge Jackson at that meeting a week from today. I want to just speak a little bit about process. Democrats have taken to repeatedly mentioning that Judge Jackson has been confirmed by the Senate three times, two of which were non-controversial, using votes for positions like the U.S. Sentencing Commission is going to make it much harder to confirm anyone to those positions. It encourages senators to apply the same standard used for evaluating Supreme Court nominations to every single position. If Democrats had applied the approach that they want Republicans to use now, that would be one thing. But we know that they haven't. Democrats have voted against nominees who were confirmed unanimously for the Circuit Court. President Biden did that four times as a United States senator. 10 other Democrats in the Senate now have done the same thing for more than one nominee. Hopefully, then, they will think hard before continuing down that road. Unfortunately, Judge Jackson's record is incomplete. That's because information has been withheld. We're missing all of Judge Jackson's non-public sentencing commission documents.
Senate Judiciary Ranking Member Chuck Grassley of Iowa. You're listening to Washington Today.
There's been much more recognition of the historic contributions of America's First Ladies in recent years. So join us as C-SPAN takes you through the White House experiences of eight modern First Ladies, from Lady Bird Johnson to Melania Trump. Using material from C-SPAN's award-winning biography series, First Ladies, and source material from the C-SPAN video library, you'll hear these first spouses talk about the issues important to them while in the White House. First Ladies in their own words. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some more headlines. Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has signed into law the state's Parental Rights in Education Bill, also known by its opponents as the Don't Say Gay Bill. It prohibits teachers from leading classroom discussions on gender identity or sexual orientation for students in kindergarten through third grade. It also bans such lessons for older students unless they are age appropriate or developmentally appropriate. Governor DeSantis said in a statement, "In Florida, we not only know that parents have a right to be involved, we insist that parents have a right to be involved." The Supreme Court was back in session today hearing cases on oral arguments in two transportation labor cases. And also back on the bench, albeit remotely, Justice Clarence Thomas. His appearance comes 3 days after court officials said he was released from the hospital following treatment for an infection. Justice Thomas was admitted to Sibley Hospital here in Washington, D.C. on March 18th after experiencing flu-like symptoms. Court officials say he was diagnosed with an infection, treated with IV antibiotics, and released on Friday. A coalition of progressive and environmental organizations have unveiled a Green New Deal pledge for 2022 House and Senate candidates. Signers of the pledge commit to rejecting any donations of more than $200 from fossil fuel lobbyists, companies, or executives, and commit to co-sponsoring 10 pieces of Green New Deal-related legislation within 6 months of taking office. Candidates who have taken the pledge include Jessica Cisneros, who will face Representative Henry Cuellar, a Democrat from Texas, in a July runoff. Also, three other House candidates in North Carolina and in Pennsylvania. More than 50 groups collaborated on the pledge, including the Sunrise Movement, the Working Families Party, Our Revolution, Public Citizen, and Greenpeace. Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich suffered symptoms of a suspected poisoning after a meeting in Kiev, Ukraine, earlier this month, according to a report by the BBC. Abramovich, who is the owner for the Premier League soccer team Chelsea FC, reportedly suffered sore eyes and skin peeling. Two Ukrainian officials were also said to have been affected. Sources familiar with the matter told the Wall Street Journal that they blame the attack on Russians who want to derail ongoing peace talks. The journal also reported that Mr. Abramovich and the three other officials from Ukraine have recovered. The incident reportedly occurred on March 3rd. Nearly 4 million refugees have fled Ukraine since Russia invaded the country more than a month ago. That's according to the latest estimate from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Poland is by far the top destination, hosting some 2.3 million refugees from the war, with Romania, Moldova, Hungary, and Slovakia seeing numbers in the hundreds of thousands. President Biden is saying he makes no apologies after his weekend comment that Russian President Vladimir Putin cannot remain in power. The president also insisted he's not calling for regime change in Moscow. Here he is talking to NBC News' Kelly O'Donnell about the issue.
Do you believe what you said, that Putin can't remain in power? Or do you now regret saying that because your government has been trying to walk that back? Did your words complicate matters?
Well, you asked three different questions. I'll answer them all. Number one, I'm not walking anything back. The fact of the matter is I was expressing the more outrage I felt toward the way Putin is dealing and the actions of this man. Just brutality. Half the children in Ukraine. I had just come from being with those families. But I want to make it clear. I wasn't then, nor am I now, articulating a policy change. I was expressing the moral outrage that I feel, and I make no apologies for it.
My personal
feelings. Secondly, you asked me about, what was the second part?
Complicate the diplomacy of this moment.
No, I don't think it does. You know, the fact is that we're in a situation where what complicates the situation of the moment is the escalatory efforts of Putin to continue and engage in carnage, the kind of behavior that that makes the whole world say, my God, what is this man doing? That's what complicates things a great deal. But I don't think it complicates it at all.
Also today, Republican Representative Mark Green of Tennessee talked about his trip with other members of Congress last week to Eastern Europe. He told Fox News that the bipartisan group were unified in believing the U.S. must impose harsher sanctions on Ukraine and on Russia and give lethal aid to Ukraine.
Well, Dana, you know, it was both heart-wrenching and heartwarming. Heart-wrenching in that we got to hear the stories directly from the refugees, you know, their homes being bombed, people, you know, being killed, images of children being killed, heart-wrenching stories, and then heartwarming as you see the people of Poland and Romania and Moldova opening up their homes. There are no refugee camps there, and millions of people have come into Poland, and they're just taking them into their homes. The NGOs and the U.S. government, the humanitarian assistance has been fantastic. Mark Murphy, the you know, world-renowned chef, we went to a place where they were cooking meals for the people. It very heartwarming to see the response, very heartbreaking just to see the devastation in these people's lives.
So this was a bipartisan delegation, and we know that there's a lot of polarization in the country, a lot of partisanship. What was the feeling amongst the congressional members there from both sides of the aisle?
Well, the delegation was really unified in the need to change our response. You know, the president has pushed sort of a punish Russia perspective, and that hasn't worked. What we really need to do, and again, the delegation The congressional delegation was unified in this. We need to prevent Russia from doing further things, and that means harder sanctions, more lethal aid, and things like that. We also met with members of the 82nd Airborne Division, the 101st, and the American troops that are deployed there on NATO's eastern flank, and the delegation was completely in agreement in supporting those forces and, of course, growing them where we can.
Do you think that the Congress will continue to pressure the Biden administration to do more? And I'd also love to get your thoughts on the gaffe heard around the world over the weekend when President Biden ad-libbed those nine words.
Yeah. The Congress is going to continue to push the president on this. You know, you can credit the Democrats for the bill they passed on Russian oil, you know, blocking Russian oil. They actually, the Democrats in Congress, helped push that bill through. So, again, there's Putin has unified NATO, he's unified the EU, and he's unified Congress. As far as the gaffe, you know, the president's just, I mean, it's sad to see stuff like that happen. He needs to stick to his speeches, you know, the written word, because when he deviates, that kind of a mistake can inflame Putin, the very thing we're trying not to do. And, you know, he's just got to watch what he says. What presidents say matter.
Republican Representative Mark Green of Tennessee earlier today on Fox News. The House returned today from its week-long district work period. Members will vote later in the week on legalizing marijuana at the federal level. With more on what to expect in Congress this week, here's Joe Garrison of USA Today and Siobhan Hughes of The Wall Street Journal.
Well, as you know, President Biden unexpectedly to aides and White House officials ended his speech in Warsaw with the comment, "For God's sakes, this man cannot remain in power." That was an ad-lib that the White House quickly sought to backtrack. Within 15 minutes, a White House official tried to clarify that Biden was referring to Putin could not continue to exercise power in the Ukraine region. So I think we're going to see more of that today in terms of walking back the president's statement. President Biden was asked yesterday evening as he was leaving his church in Georgetown, a reporter shouted, "Were you supporting a regime change?" Biden said in one word, "No." And so today we're going to have our first time to ask in a press briefing setting White House officials what Biden meant by that. And so I think we're going to continue to hear more what we've heard since he made those comments on Saturday afternoon.
That press briefing is where you're going to talk to about it. Do you expect that the president himself will address it or any of his foreign policy?
I think there's a good chance he will. So at 12:45 p.m. today, he will be announcing his budget, which is going to include a new tax on the wealthiest Americans. It's called the billionaire income tax. It'll target 700 Americans who earn $100 million or more. And I think there will be a chance for reporters to at least shout questions to him on that topic. And I would be surprised if he did not respond back in some way. We'll see.
Siobhan Hughes, we saw a couple of members of Congress talk about these statements, and particularly, and depending on their political positionings, making the appropriate response that you would expect. What do you expect Congress to respond to this, and particularly what it does for foreign policy efforts for those involved in that in Congress?
Well, Republicans have already come out pretty strongly against Joe Biden to condemn the remarks, to say they were unhelpful, to say they were a setback to diplomatic efforts. And given that Republicans have tried to focus on Biden's handling of Ukraine in ways to, you know, say that he's not handling the job of the presidency well, I would expect that to continue. I would expect Democrats in a lot of ways to try to, you know, gloss over it a little bit. Democrats have largely been fairly happy with how Joe Biden has handled the situation in Ukraine and the aggressive sort of belligerent remarks that were, you know, made on an off-the-cuff basis are not really helpful to the Democratic Party.
When it comes then to those foreign policy folks in Congress, particularly those who serve on the committees, have they responded in a sense of what it does to, or the statements might do to complicate foreign policy efforts in Ukraine?
Well, the top Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has responded, as has Senator Rob Portman, who is playing a big role in Ukraine, again, underscoring that it's a setback to diplomatic efforts. In part, what it does is it divides NATO. In another part, what it does is has the potential to rile up Vladimir Putin at a time when the international community is trying to be a little bit more calming, a little bit less provocative. And so that's where the danger lies.
Siobhan Hughes, now that he's back in the United States, domestic issues that the White House and Congress has to deal with, what's facing them as far as things they want to see achieved, particularly before the midterm elections later this year?
Well, on the domestic front, we're going to see some of that when the budget is released earlier today. And it's not just the fact of those budget numbers where you're going to see Biden reverse course from where he was a year ago and talk about more defense spending. But it's also in terms of trying to salvage the Build Back Better agenda, as it was formerly known. Things like, could they do anything in the area of drug pricing? West Virginia Democrat has indicated he is willing to re-engage on some components of that plan, notably the tax credits for renewable and alternative energy. Also combined with some deficit reduction, you heard my USA Today colleague just talk about the tax on billionaires. Some of that could be used to finance these agenda items, but another portion of that deficit reduction. And so the president and his Democratic allies want to see if there's anything in that vein they can get done before the midterms bear down on us.
Wall Street Journal congressional reporter Siobhan Hughes and Joey Garrison, USA Today's White House correspondent from this morning's Washington Journal. You can find the entire program at cspan.org/WJ and on the free C-SPAN Now video app. And finally, the U.S. Capitol reopened to the public for guided tours today, 2 years after the coronavirus pandemic closed the complex to all but employees. The reopening plans were laid out in a joint memo from House Attending Physician Brian Monahan and House Sergeant-at-Arms William Walker. Starting today, congressional members and staff are allowed to lead tour groups of 15 people or less. That includes school groups. The complex will reopen in phases over the next 2 months, with Capitol Dome tours slated to begin on April 25th, and the Capitol Visitor Center reopening to a limited number of visitors on May 30th. The move marks the latest relaxation of COVID-19 restrictions here in Washington, D.C. Mask requirements inside the Capitol were relaxed weeks ago. Also reopening on April 1st, the U.S. Botanic Garden, which is just west of the Capitol. A reminder that this program is available as a podcast. You can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.